Hello everybody and welcome back to Transmission. It's me, Quentin, and this week we've got Ravi Sharma, Director of Development for Energy Storage at Deriva Energy. So for the energy transition to work, we're only just getting started with batteries. We need tens and tens of gigawatts in each region. And so the job of the developer is a very important one. Selecting sites, finding contractors, getting grid connections, all that stuff. And so in this conversation with Ravi, we talk about strategies for developing sites and choosing the right places and some of the regulatory changes and hurdles that are on the horizon. So I really enjoyed this conversation. Ravi knows his stuff and we go down a few rabbit holes. If you like this, hit like, subscribe and all the good buttons. It means we can increase our reach and do more awesome stuff for a bigger audience. And now let's jump in. Hello, Ravi, and welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So Deriva Energy, can you just tell our audience what is the company and what do you do?
Yeah, so we've been around for about a year and a half, which doesn't sound like a lot, but we have a legacy behind us. So we were originally Duke Energy, which is one of the largest utilities in the U.S. So we were their IPP arm. So we developed commercial renewables across the U.S., whereas they are a regulated utility. And so about, you know, the team's been around for developing renewables for about 17 years. So I've been in the space for a while. And about back in 2022, there was an announcement that we were going to be for sale. And in 2023, we were acquired by Brookfield. So they're a big private equity and asset manager. So that's a bit about us.
And so what's it been like in the last year and a half with new ownership?
Yeah.
What does it mean for the business? Brookfield are absolutely gigantic, right? So I'm assuming this means a capital injection and you can really get to the races.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'll say there's always like changes, right? As you start with a new organization, but it's really been great. So I believe that they are one of the largest investors in battery storage globally. I think they've made some pretty big announcements recently on acquisitions. And what's really cool about them is, you know, they're kind of creating this ecosystem, I'd say, of different portfolio companies that they own, and where we can kind of exchange ideas in terms of best practices or maybe some market, I won't say market, like competitive intelligence, but more around, you know, if there's activity or new business models coming out in Australia, maybe that's a precursor to what we may see in the US, right? So kind of sharing those ideas and then just around procurement and scale and things. So we can kind of play at a bigger scale, whereas we may not be able to if we were just all alone.
And so before we move on specifically to developing assets, what's your role there? And what's the bigger company look like, the wider company? How many people are there? And could you talk a little bit about your activities? So which markets you're in and some of the milestones you guys have already met?
Yeah, so I'm a project developer. I lead our energy storage development team. We're relatively small, but we've got a couple of folks. We, as a company, we're about a little over 500 people. It's broken up. I mean, we do a lot of wind and solar development and of course storage, but other divisions, right, are more kind of within the finance organization, within the operations organization. We have a pretty large operations team. We've got 6 gigawatts out there and operating. And so they were fully kind of capable to maintain our assets and even offer third-party services to other operators out there.
And which regions do you focus on?
So we are pretty widespread across the U.S. In terms of storage, we're in ERCOT. We have a little bit of activity in CAISO, PJM, MISO, and some of the southeastern markets. Also have a little bit in WECC. I'd say where we're not, right? Because you can't be everywhere and be good at everything. So we are, you know, oftentimes not, or we're not in the Northeast. You know, those are good storage markets, but, you know, I think it really boils down to where your team has expertise and, you know, making sure that you're kind of leveraging their expertise.
Okay. So Ravi, in this episode, we are going to have a go at talking through how you actually develop a site in the United States. So everything from choosing a site, selecting the best place and grid connections and whatnot, all the way through to construction and deployment and getting into the markets. And so I'm excited about this conversation because you and your team do this. This is your bread and butter day in, day out. And we're going to have a go at talking through each step in quite a bit of detail. So can you just give us the 10,000 foot view? What does it mean to be a developer and what are the steps?
So I like to think of development really in kind of three phases, right? Very simply, early stage, mid stage, and late stage. Now, some developers in the US focus on just one stage. So you may have a developer that their specialty is land acquisition and siting and getting into a market really early. And their thesis is really then to flip their projects to, right, other developers that will carry a project through later stages and eventually construction and operation. So we kind of span the whole spectrum. We also do, right, acquire from others or at times we may sell projects. But within each of those stages, there are then different disciplines, right? So, or there are different areas within kind of the project team. You know, you could have, right, engineering, interconnection, permitting and environmental functions. You may have local affairs, folks that understand the kind of what the local dynamics are in terms of the zoning and ordinances and moratoriums in some cases. But as a developer, right, our role fundamentally, I believe, is to manage risk and uncertainty. And there's a lot of that as you're taking a project from a pure, as we call, greenfield or blank slate, all the way to an asset that, you know, you may be deploying hundreds of millions of dollars and it's an asset that's going to be in operation for 20 plus years, right? So, you know, I think our role is to, as we advance projects, to de-risk them, right? And so a lot of uncertainty is thrown at us. There's a lot of uncertainty in the market right now. And we discover risks, we figure out how to mitigate them. And as we do that, right, the project value essentially increases, right? I mean, risk and return. So as we de-risk and advance a project through its phases and milestones, we are creating value and we can choose to exit a project at a particular time, or we may choose to keep that project for ourselves and operate it, right, for 20 plus years. But maybe let's start through the phases, right? So, you know, early stage, a developer and some shops have their own strategy teams and they figure out where across the US, right, they might want to position themselves and leverage their strengths. So, you know, once you've kind of decided on what market you want to target, and market in this context doesn't have to be just an ISO or an RTO, right? It can be a state or even a utility region. But we start with site acquisition, right? And there's a prospecting effort where, right, a team of analysts or GIS specialists will, right, kind of comb through mapping and we'll look at various layers and factors or criteria in order to identify sites that could be valuable. You know, once we've kind of honed in on a site that we want to pursue, there's a real estate effort, of course, right? I mean, it's really, you know, engaging landowners. There could be a land agent that is, you know, sending out mailers or phone calls, right? It's down to that level. Some people even knock on doors, right? And so it's securing land and then starting to de-risk that land within the early stage. So we may do some engaging with like a local planning board to understand ordinances, which will kind of define maybe some of the restrictions we have on the site, or a moratorium, which is basically you cannot build this technology for maybe a period of time. We need to understand some of the permitting that could be done through what's called a permit matrix or environmental constraints analysis. And, you know, all that kind of leads up to, you know, more of the interconnection and grid studies, right? So we'll look at line capacity. We'll try to get estimates for, you know, maybe what network upgrades could be for a particular size project. That's kind of a real guesstimate. It's a really complex process. we'll look at interconnection and see maybe what the cost might be for interconnecting to a particular substation, or if you're line tapping, it's often a higher expense. And then, you know, once we file an interconnect application and we get in the queue in most parts of the US, that kind of ends the early stage, right, phase of a project. As we go to mid stage, it's really more about digging into the weeds, right? So we want to get into details around, you know, start advancing the engineering design for the project. We are going to be ramping up permitting efforts for the project. You know, there could be cases where we need what's called a discretionary permit. It may be referred to as like a conditional use permit. And so that could be a situation where we need to engage with a planning board or with a you know, board of county commissioners, things like that. So, you know, to really get permission to build a project subject to certain conditions and mitigations, that we make sure we're doing things the right way. You know, I would say it's also advancing the economics picture and the business side of each project. So, you know, you'll be running financial models. You'll be trying to understand which customers you wanna target if you're going that route, and putting together that commercial picture and investment thesis.
It's interesting you describe them as customers. I've never really thought about it like that.
Yeah,
but they are customers. It is. It's like a. I don't want to diminish it at all. It's a incredibly valuable and tricky and high risk and an exciting, challenging thing to do to be a developer. But it is a bit like a factory, right? You're prospecting and you're working materials through a funnel from greenfield parcels of land all the way through to packaged for a customer to buy. Never really thought about it like that before.
Yeah. And, you know, customers, I think we can refer to in different contexts, right? So maybe I should use the term like your commercial contract or your offtake contract. But, you know, in markets, as you probably know better than I do, you know, in a market like ERCOT, there's different financial products that you can put on, you know, a battery. But in other markets, you know, a customer could refer to a utility counterparty that, right, they are, you know, they're who we're serving under a 15 or 20 year tolling agreement, right? And so they really are our customer, and you know, I think the industry probably should treat them that way. Yeah. So
can I just zoom in on one part there? So well, there's so much you talked about, but specifically finding good grid connections, right? How do you know whether a site's going to be a go? I say you've got your Wellington boots on and you're going stomping the land somewhere out in California, and you think this is a marvelous piece of land. It totally makes sense. We're right next to a substation. How do you then figure out whether that's a good substation without spending a load of money?
Well, it's a great question, and I'd say it's a really tricky thing to do. Because, you know, there are tools that can help us think through that analysis in terms of how much line capacity might be available. And there are tools that can, you know, help us think through what potential network upgrades, which means upgrades to the system as a result of you putting that battery there, to try to estimate what that cost allocation may be. Though that is a very challenging thing to do, because in like a cluster queue process, things are constantly moving through the phases. You can have generators dropping and costs being reallocated. Using consultants is another one, and some organizations, right, also have kind of an in-house team that will run analysis on understanding the cost. And if I would just say one more thing on that, is that is a critical piece today, probably more than ever, because the upgrades that projects can be assigned in certain markets can be massive, right? So you can end up with, as you're already advanced the project to some mid stage, you've already poured money into this project, and you can be allocated as a result of a study, if you get it wrong, right, tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars in upgrades, which makes a project like not feasible anymore, tens maybe you can work with, but depending on the size, hundreds maybe not.
I've got this idea in my head that, I don't know, a decade ago, you could get in your truck and drive around and you'd happen upon a substation and there would just be a spare transformer bay sat there, you know, and a couple of hundred MVA kicking about and a big, beautiful piece of land with no flood risk and no, you know, no dwellings, no houses or businesses for miles. Was it like that? And do you ever find them like that, or has all the low hanging fruit gone? And we're now into like the really hard technical stuff.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. So like the industry is changed. There's a lot of competition these days. I'll give the example of, you know, when you're out there prospecting and actually starting to engage with landowners, it's almost difficult to find a site. Like if it's a good site, then odds are five other people have looked at it already or will as you're kind of trying to engage. And so I think, you know, we see competition around us all the time. So I think that drives developers maybe to less desirable locations or sometimes line taps, things like that. And look, it's a lot of decisions. So everyone has their own strengths and view of the market. And I think, you know, people have to make tough decisions and you kind of pick your poison in which one you want to, you know, you want to work through and which one is a fatal flaw for you.
So let's say hypothetically, you're looking at three options. Options are bad words here because of options to lease and whatnot. But let's say three opportunities for developing sites. How do you, you know, what's your decision-making process? How do you figure out whether something is worth the time? How do you decide, you know, you must have a sixth sense for this now where you just know what good looks like in the same way that, you know, a property developer has a sixth sense for, you know, where there's going to be good value creation. So how do you think about that problem, Ravi? What does your spider sense look out for?
Yeah. You know, so as I mentioned, like we look at a lot of different criteria, some matters more than others. And, you know, I think it's really, you know, first and foremost, are there fatal flaws with the site? So sometimes you may find something like a high risk on the environmental side. You may also, you know, see results from your tools that, you know, that say there's a large network upgrades estimated. And, you know, I'll say personally, but, you know, as an organization as well, like you've run enough financial models, right, where you kind of get a sense of, you know, what buttons and knobs and dials, right, are going to, in financial terms, right, there's obviously the fatal flaws, but in financial terms, kind of dial you into a price tag or target return, right, that is within market and something that you would be willing to accept. So having the tools available is helpful, but if after you run quite a few of them, you kind of get a sense for what really matters and what you can work through.
So if you were pitching your company, Deriva, and you were saying, hey, this is what we're really good at, right? Of course you have scale, right? You're a very large company and you have financial backing. So that's a good start. That's actually quite rare for developers. So congratulations to you and the team for that. But what's your secret sauce? Like, what's the edge that you guys have? What's the thing that you do better than everyone else?
I think it's really, you know, we leverage our team's experience. I think that's a big one. And I think some of that collaboration that I mentioned earlier, like we are extremely collaborative within Deriva. So, you know, while we are, you know, have scale, as you mentioned, you know, I've heard from friends of mine or others in the industry who maybe have worked at very large, like I'll say much larger development shops, and they're extremely siloed. And so, you know, I think where we fit is kind of in that middle ground where, you know, we're not so big that, you know, our processes and procedures will strangle us to death and we can't move that quickly and we can't talk to each other that readily and we have to put something in a workflow and I can't just, you know, ask for something. So I think that's really where, you know, where we feel, or at least I feel, on the storage and development side where we're strong. We do have other strengths, I believe, like in our financing team and our operations team that I mentioned earlier.
Now I'm going to ask you about some of the challenges. So what gets in the way? What gets in the way of getting these projects developed?
Fatal flaws get in the way, right? So if you missed something through your diligence, right, that can get in the way. But I'll share, you know, I think there's one that's common to developing all technologies, and that's, you know, that's being able to navigate the interconnection queue. You've probably heard that from plenty of people, right? There's delays. It's very complex. You can get this, you know, allocation of high upgrades that, you know, that can be challenging for a project to get past. But for storage specifically, maybe I'll give three. You know, I think one, which you already hit on, is this competitive land acquisition dynamic in the early stage, right? So, you know, how long that lasts, right, where everyone's kind of chasing the same, like similar opportunities, I think we'll see, right? There may be some consolidation. There may be some, you know, some of those may be early stage developers that intend to flip. And so, right, things may correct a little bit. The second, I think, is around, it's tied to interconnection, but it's really battery specific, because batteries as opposed to renewables, you know, usually in most markets, ERCOT is different. You know, we're including capacity value in the value stack. And when you do that, you really, or to receive that value or participate in that market, you really need a higher level of interconnection service than you may, let's say, for an energy-only renewable asset.
So just to stop you there, what does that mean that you're considering the capacity value in the value stack? I think is what you said, something like that.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, yeah, again, not maybe for your ERCOT listeners, but it's for probably most of the others across the country. So, you know, in some markets in the U.S., we have capacity markets, PJM, MISO, New York, et cetera. And, you know, there you're really, you know, it kind of goes back to this concept of having enough resources available on the grid in the case of, say, an extreme event, an emergency. And so the way that number, how many megawatts are needed, right, on the grid is there's load forecasts or demand forecasts that are performed. And then they add typically a reserve margin on top of that, so a safety factor. And then that kind of sets the number of megawatts of resources that are needed in a particular region or market. And so resources that may not run much or may not have a regular energy or ancillary service opportunity are still needed for that one really, really hot day on the 4th of July, for example. And so typically those are gas turbine peakers, and now, right, batteries are kind of taking some of that or filling some of those same needs. And so with that, right, you're basically paid, right, to be installed and available and operating. You have must offer obligations in the day ahead market, but it's really, you know, when you're called upon, you need to deliver. And in return, right, as an asset owner, there can be compensation for that. So it can come through an auction, or in California or SPP or a few others, you know, that's really more of a bilateral kind of a dynamic than a auction.
Ravi, I've got to say, I think you, by accident there, gave the best explanation I think we've ever heard on this podcast of how a capacity market or capacity value, or capacity as a word, works in the US. Because as a European, we have lots of different ways, lots of different types of capacity market that confuses us. And that was terrific. Thank you. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are going to really appreciate that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to move on now to So what's got to change, right? So if you had a wish list of things that, let's say regulatory changes that could make your life a bit easier, what's holding us back? I asked you before what gets in the way, but what's holding us back?
I'll throw out a couple. You know, I think there's still, you know, work to be done or room for improvement on storage resources being studied and allocated upgrades in a way that is representative of their actual operating model. So storage, if you're a fully deliverable, right, a network resource, right, you may be assessed based on, right, injecting 24 hours a day. Obviously, we don't inject batteries 24 hours a day. I'm not an expert in this area, but, I would say I'm sure that there are reasons why it's done the way it's done from a fairness perspective. I think there's also challenges with the actual software that ISOs and utilities are running, right? I mean, they're doing very complex analysis and I would imagine that this requires quite a bit of change to that, right, to that infrastructure. Others, I would say, I'll just throw out two more. One is really around, I think, long duration storage, right? It's not an area that I'm strongly focused on personally, but I think that in order for that to advance, we need to see not only demand in the market, but value put on a long duration resource. So, things like ELCC values, right, or capacity, right, values need to represent kind of or value that longer duration. There's also the procurement route. So in California, for example, there's starting to be more mandated procurement for long duration storage. But seeing that more across the US, I think, would be interesting. And then just lastly, the area I kind of love to think about and see evolve is really on the business models, right? So, I think, right now in today's world, and we talked a little about ERCOT, but in a lot of the other markets, it's a utility space or load serving entity space, right? Where you are contracting with those entities. I think business models will continue to evolve. The corporate market is really active for renewables. I think it's somewhat untapped. And frankly, I think they need to understand what value can batteries actually bring to them. But as things evolve, right, I think seeing the new business models and across the US, it's exciting, but it's also a challenge, right, for projects, because we have a smaller customer pool than maybe renewables do.
So Ravi, this is your chance to plug something. Is there anything that you want to get out to our listeners, to the world of energy storage, that you think they need to hear? This is your opportunity to sell or to plug.
Yeah, I'm going to take maybe a slightly different route here than maybe just the energy storage world. So, I think there's, across the industry from a people and talent perspective, obviously there's a strong interest in people from, that bring a lot of experience or even folks that, right, have 2 to 5 years of experience. But I think that there's a bit of a gap. I think the industry as a whole can do a better job in terms of training and developing young folks, maybe coming right out of undergrad. We have, over the last 2 or 3 years, ramped up our internship and co-op program. And it's been very successful, right? It involves projects and some formal kind of curriculum where folks like myself and my peers, right, are maybe kind of teaching a little module. And we've retained a lot of those folks. And I think that we oftentimes, maybe we're both guilty of this, I know I am, but, we're often too busy to kind of take the time and, explain something or, work one-on-one with someone. And I think the more we all do, the better off we are.
Totally agree. That sounds like a great program, actually.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, now to everybody's favorite question. So Ravi, what is your contrarian view? What's the thing that you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
I'm not sure if it's contrarian or not, but I'll throw it out there. So, I think a lot of folks in the industry may think that battery storage is going to evolve across the US in the same or similar fashion that it's evolved in the mature markets like Texas and California. And I think that in many parts of the U.S., as we kind of move west, right, from west to east, you know, I think we'll see utilities flexing a little bit more of their muscle in terms of, right, a desire to own assets. And look, I mean, I came from a utility company, and look, I mean, this is, they have the right to kind of defend their business model. And so I think we'll see them really focusing on repowering their assets that they already have, on land they already have, next to substations that they already have, right, you know, control of, and or using surplus capacity. We can get into that. That's a whole FERC order. But using the excess to add batteries and make sure they have more flexible and effective assets. So, you know, I think that's, maybe people are not fully understanding that. And I feel like that dynamic is something people are going to have to work through.
And so what would that actually mean then? What would be the consequence?
You know, the way you develop in these markets is a little bit different, right? Because you have, in some cases, right, they're also your customer, right? And so if it's having a presence, you know, in kind of the utility commission space, right, in terms of advocacy, it's also doing research into, right, understanding their IRPs and procurement needs. But this may evolve, right, or may end up in the form of developers, right, flipping pre-notice to proceed, or kind of as projects are in a late stage, where developers that are used to kind of taking the earlier stage development risk that utilities can't take, right, because they're not allowed to take as much of that development risk as we might. So, you know, I think there's a more of a flip model there, or build transfers is something that I think we'll see a lot more of.
Does that mean that demand for developed assets could be much less than what's currently priced into the market?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think if you have a project is pretty advanced, that there's going to be value for it. You know, I think I would maybe just, you know, caution against, you know, seeing, I'll say, the, you know, exciting, you know, ERCOT LMP map and the hedges and put options and all kind of interesting structures that we might see in Texas, or, you know, or duck curve effects in California. Just seeing that dynamic play out, I don't think we'll see that dynamic play out as heavily in, you know, I in these vertically integrated markets more towards the east. And I think, you know, I think there's value there. It's just a different kind of value.
Ravi, it was absolutely awesome to have you on a podcast. Thank you for joining us. And we wish you and the team the best of luck as you continue gallivanting around the United States, finding the right sites and getting batteries on them. I would love to welcome you on a podcast again to find out how you've been doing in a few months, well, in a year's time or so.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, would love the opportunity, and yeah, appreciate you taking the time here.
Thank you very much.